Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing. Always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true transparency pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Really looking forward to the 1 o'clock hour, because with game seven coming up, we've got the guy who's been covering this series from the very beginning. Scott Burnside from The Athletic is in studio with us. He was one of the national hockey writers for ESPN.com. He was there for 13 years, I believe, and like Paul, was laid off recently. But after a year with the Dallas Stars, he's now with The Athletic and doing great work, and he's nice enough to join us in studio for this hour. Scott, it's great to have you in.
I'm very pleased to be here, and thanks. I got a ride over from Centennial. It's nice and hot out. Made it successfully from Winnipeg after Game 6. I'm ready. I got my game face on.
What's the change in climate like from Winnipeg to Nashville?
Yeah, you know what? It was very nice in Winnipeg. Not quite as humid, but I got a nice walk on the along the Red River. It's and I'll tell you, I said this a number of times during the series, but I'm not sure there are two markets that love their teams with the depth of passion that these two markets do. And it's a treat to, you know, to walk to the arena in Winnipeg and you see all those people and you understand how important that team is to that community. That's, you know, hockey. I mean, it's a trite thing to say, but hockey is life for them. And that Jets are like oxygen, and they, you know, they want very much for their team to win. But very friendly, very respectful, and I think you say the same thing about Nashville fans. I just think the NHL's has got a gold mine here in terms of this series and in terms of the passion that both these markets, very small markets, and markets that have gone through some tough times for both of them, and to see them playing at such a high level, it's, you know, this is gold.
You heading over to Justin Timberlake tonight on your big night off?
You know what? I respect Justin Timberlake, and I'm sure he will put on a fine show. But I would be taking up space. So I would not be running.
You and me both.
Scott Burnside in studio with us. We were discussing while you were on your way over here about the fourth line tomorrow and what it could look like. Does it look like Hartman will be in for Fisher?
That would be my guess. Of course, Peter Laviolette keeps those things.
Right.
That's his thing. I'm not sure why you wouldn't share that, but, you know, I don't pretend to be an NHL head coach, but that would be my guess, is that Hartman would come back in. And, you know, it's been interesting to watch how Peter Laviolette has handled the lineup during this series. I was, you know, frankly, a bit surprised, A, that he put Scott Hartnell in for Kevin Fiala in game four, and then equally surprised that he took Scott Hartnell out again for game five, which, yeah. Lots of coaches, you know, you don't mess with a winning combination. So I was a bit surprised. And then, of course, to see Hartnell back in, and I thought played very, very well. And he played on a fourth line in game six. But I thought he was, in both games, he's been a force that is, you know, makes the Predators look a little bit differently. And I don't know whether it's coincidence or not. You can argue it one way or the other. But Dustin Byfuglien, definitely not a factor in games four and six. Certainly a huge factor throughout the series. And in game five was no different. Game five is the catalyst to, you know, what was an embarrassing loss for the Predators. So, you know, it's been interesting to watch the lineup, you know, with Mike Fisher. I think the Hartman thing, that makes sense to move him back in. The key for him to be effective is he's got to stay out of the box, right? He can't lose his mind. So, he's a smart player. Presumably, you know, understanding the stakes, he comes back in the lineup and he can be effective. I thought that fourth line with Fisher and Salomaki at one point, but I thought that fourth line has been effective. You know,
it has been. Yeah,
Hartman has done some good things. So. It'll be interesting to see, but that would be my guess.
How are you at guessing NHL injuries? It seems like it's part of the gig. What do you suspect Mike Fisher's deal is?
I have no idea. And in fact, we talked about it. We went back, tried to see what had happened.
There's nothing there.
Where he might have, you know, just didn't, you know, was it start of the second or whenever it was? It was
earlier than that, I think.
Right at the end of the first period.
Yeah. was like, okay, they're short a guy on the bench. You go through the numbers, and then you're trying to find something that happened. But so I have no sense of it. It's unfortunate too, because again, I thought Mike Fisher, especially in, you know, as this series has gone on, I think he's been very good, and I think he's done exactly what they need him to do. And I think he, you know, you can never, you know, how do you quantify it? But his presence, I think, in the lineup has been very important for this team since he came back, and certainly in the playoffs, because it hasn't been a straight line for them, right? It hasn't been a smooth ride for the Preds really at all this spring. And it's, I think Mike Fisher is a very important part of that. And so it'll be interesting to see what, you know, assuming his absence in game seven, whether, you know, what, you know, what happens with when he's not there.
They obviously built depth so that they could handle something like this after getting hurt a lot last year and maybe not having quite what they needed in the final. How much might they miss his face-off presence in a game seven?
Well, this is, you know, possession is so important in this game, and especially it's going to be so important, I think, the way the Preds want to play and need to play. A, you want to get the lead early, and then you want to play the kind of defense we saw them play in game four and game six. And I mean, it's, you know, Winnipeg is so good. If you don't possess the puck, then you're chasing it. And the Jets have shown the ability to be very opportunistic and score in bunches. And so, you know, it's a very long answer to a very simple question. But yes, they will miss Mike Fisher because, you know, that's where it starts. And you need to be proficient on the draw. You need to be at least sort of breaking even on the draw. And Mike Fisher is a guy who that you can count on to, you know, to go out in those critical moments and take defensive zone faceoffs and help kill penalties and things like that.
Mike Fisher's been good, been solid. Kyle Turris has not been great throughout these playoffs. For someone who was an addition, a trade during the season where he thought it maybe this will put the Preds sort of over the top here with a great second line center, what's been the deal with Kyle Turris when you watch his play so far? I thought even in game six, there were times where everyone had a heavy stick and was playing great in the defensive zone for the Preds, and he was still just a little bit absent.
Yeah, well, there's no question. And Kyle Turris would be the first one to admit this is not where he's at. I don't think he got a point the other night. So what's he at? 0 goals, 3 assists, I believe, throughout the playoffs. And that's that as a second line center, that's not enough. And it's really a credit to the rest of that lineup, and certainly the big line in game six. You know, that the Preds are still in this, and they got a chance to move on, where the second line, let's give them credit. They produced the double overtime winner. So that was obviously a key moment, but game in and game out, it has been a problem for him. I talked to an NHL coach earlier in the series, and he said he's not going into the hard areas. He needs to be more aggressive. And I talked to Kyle Turris about these. I need to move my feet more. I need to be doing more to contribute. And it hasn't happened yet. And can you win this series without really meaningful production from your number two center and really, for the most part, from your number two line? Well, they're in a one game spot where they could, sure, they could do it. But certainly in game seven, it would be an opportune time for Kyle Turris to make his presence known. And I don't know whether it's the physicality. I don't know whether it's the speed at which a lot of this series has been played. But I know this NHL coach, that he needs to be more engaged in the most critical areas in the offensive zone. And it hasn't happened. And it's, he and I spoke this morning, actually. We talked about his game seven experience. Of course, he was with Ottawa last year, lost in double overtime in game seven against Pittsburgh. And, you know, we talked about some of those things. I mean, what a great story if we find him. Yeah, well, Kevin Fiala and Craig Smith. And, you know, it's not, you know, again, Kevin Fiala is interesting. He had a couple really good chances in game six. And, you know, it's not happening for him really either. And you wonder about the nerves and the, you know, those guys want, they understand that they need to produce. They understand that's their role on this team. And they, you know, it hasn't happened for them. And so, you know, the key is, you know, Kyle Turris is a veteran guy that to sort of not get too wound up and to do the things that you need to do to produce and to be a factor on the ice. So I think it's a main part of the storyline going into game seven, though, because if they do get on track, then, you know, again, it puts that much more pressure on Winnipeg.
Scott, we experienced it firsthand with Paul. You know, after 9 years, he was let go by ESPN with the budget cuts. You were there 13 years, I believe.
Correct.
And you're let go. Both of you seem to have landed in a better spot, though. He's now doing his own website. You've landed with the Athletic. What was it about the Athletic to where they wanted to feature hockey so much? Because I think it was a good start for them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't completely understand the business model, and I don't completely like I know. I spoke to the Athletic, I would say a year ago in February or March. I mean, I don't know what it was like for Paul, but at that point, there was a definite signal at ESPN that things were, that we were on the rocks, and certainly, the expectation with the hockey group was that that there were going to be changes. So I talked to them, and at that point, even, it's changed so dramatically and so quickly for the Athletic in terms of their focus. But at that point, they were still very much city focused. They were in Chicago, they were in Cleveland, they were in Toronto. Detroit was coming on board. My pal Craig Custance was at that point being courted to take over the Detroit operation, which he ultimately did. And then I think what they found is that there, the hockey fans, and especially in Canada, but really everywhere in North America, the hockey fans were hungry for this kind of content. And I think it speaks to the shrinking newspaper industry as a whole. Whether it's in Canada or the U.S., all you need to do is look at what's happening in Denver at the Denver Post, and all of the cost cutting and the shaving and the cutting of corners in sports, in newspapers as a whole, but certainly in sports and specifically in hockey. It's, in lots of American markets, it's an easy one to carve, or at least to cutting back, that's a place to start. And I think what happened with the Athletic is they found that the hockey consumer wanted this kind of content. And when they started to deliver it, it just seemed to work. And so I think they just sort of changed their focus and said, okay, well, let's get a bunch of hockey people and let's get a lot of hockey content out there. And yes, I mean, it's been fun. I've been there a month, but I mean, my pals, Pierre LeBrun has been there since, whenever he came, he and I left ESPN at the same time, and he was doing his TSN stuff, but he came on and at the start of the season with the Athletic writing for them, Craig Custance, Katie Strang, virtually everyone who wrote hockey at ESPN is now affiliated with the Athletic. And it's a treat, right? I mean, there are people you respect and you like, and it's hockey. What could go wrong?
I don't even remember the timetable now. It seems so long ago. But in terms of the pivotal, we all thought of it as a pivotal moment for the league when games were no longer on ESPN. How much did that maybe change the course of things in terms of broad public exposure, and how long did it take the league to kind of figure out its new footprint?
Yeah, I certainly coming out of the 2004-05 lockout, and the decision to go with, at that point it was Versus, and signing the long term deal with NBC, and I was at ESPN for 13 years, so I never knew ESPN at a time when they actually had the games on. I mean, the only time we ever had the product on was during the World Cup of Hockey a year ago in the fall, and it wasn't great for on a number of different levels. It just wasn't very good, and I think it's, the change at ESPN, and I think the way people consume now is so different. I know that ESPN has always been interested in the hockey. They were in until the last minute bidding on the new deal that NBC had the right of refusal, and they were always going to pay more. So, but ESPN was in right to the end, and it'll be interesting to see when the contract comes up and whether they try and splinter. There's always been discussions about, would ESPN take some playoffs and could they split it like they do with the NBA playoffs? And is there a way that, could share the wealth sort of thing? So, I mean, I think, who wouldn't want to see hockey back on ESPN? I mean, of course, I think it would be great for the game. But I think the game's popularity is different now because it's consumed so differently. And my sense is that the game is as strong as it's ever been. The ownership group, around the 31 teams, all you have to do is look at Vegas now and what they've done. That Seattle's coming at $650 million. I think the NHL's in a pretty good spot, whether it's on ESPN or not.
Scott Burnside in studio with us. You wrote a piece after Game 4 about Laviolette and the lineup change. And we've praised Laviolette for knowing his roster and when to make those right choices. But to take it a layer deeper, David Poile deserves credit for the coaching change with Laviolette, the organization as a whole, but Poyle stuck around, new head coach in with Barry Trotz now in Washington. Going back to that year, Scott, how massive of a decision was that to make at the time? How did it change the course for the Predators organization from the way you saw it?
Yeah, well, I think there's, I mean, when you look at the successful franchises around the NHL, and to me, one of the key parts is consistency and stability. And you look at the franchises that stink, and I would, you know, it's by and large, they're franchises that don't have stability, and they don't, you know, they don't draft and develop well. They're unstable, and they change directions, and they change coaches. And, you know, Dallas is, and I'm not saying Dallas is unstable, but Dallas Stars will have a third head coach in 3 years, right? They went from Lindy Ruff to Ken Hitchcock and now to Jim Montgomery. I don't, that's not stability. And I know that's not what Jim Neal, the GM, wants, but it is what it is. And it's, you know, so to your question, you know, Nashville is the epitome of stability and consistency. And I'm sure, well, I know it was very hard. It was hard for Barry Trotz and for David Poyle after all, with that relationship and all that they had done to build this team here and build it not just on the ice, but in the community and make it happen. They wrote out the potential move of the team to Hamilton. You wrote out the, you know, and that was difficult too, because when the change in ownership happened, David Poyle had very few resources to build the team that he wanted to build. And they were still successful on many fronts in spite of those kinds of issues. And, but there, you know, it was time, right? I mean, I think everyone understood that. And that's why, you know, when Barry Trotz comes back for the All-Star game, he's treated like a god because he deserves to be treated that way. And I'm, you know, I, there isn't anyone here who, you know, that isn't extremely happy for Barry Trotz to finally get over the hill, personally, and of course with the Washington Capitals by beating Pittsburgh and going to the first conference final for that franchise since 1998. People here still respect and love Barry Trotz, but Peter Laviolette is a very different coach. Right? He approaches the game differently. He sees it differently. For me, you know, the great eye opener was I sat down with Ryan Ellis before the start of the Colorado series. We had a long chat, and I talked to a bunch of people who had Ryan Ellis Jr. in Windsor, Warren Reichel, and teammates. And, you know, Peter Laviolette made the opportunity for Ryan Ellis. And Ryan Ellis is, he's unbelievable. And it's going to be amazing to see what he's going to command with his next contract, right? Because this is the most beautiful team-friendly contract around for a guy of his
ability. Yes, it is.
And he is going to get paid. He's going to get paid big. So whether it's here in Nashville or not, but that's Peter Laviolette. He opens that door for Ryan Ellis. And David Poyle trusts Peter Laviolette and trusts what he brings to the table, what he wants to do. And so he makes a move like trading Shea Weber for PK Subban. And he makes a move to bring in Ryan Johansson for Seth Jones. That's, you know, Ryan Johansson, I think, has been a beast this spring. I think he's been off the charts good. But there are a lot of people who are like wondering, well, I don't know. He's kind of big, he's kind of lanky. Is he, you know, he's got a little Joe Thornton in him. And he loves Joe Thornton. It's funny because there are people who are like, well, I don't know. You know, that is that deal going to work out? But it has. And that's, to me, the relationship between David Poyle and Peter Laviolette. Here's what we need to do to play the way that I think we need to play to be successful. And the two of them have worked to build this kind of roster. So,
well, and one more organization question for you, because you talked about the, you know, the near move to Hamilton and everything that's going on with ownership group. And I know just a couple weeks ago, the Preds announced a new chairman of the board with their ownership group. Is this a situation that's now stable enough that can withstand, let's say, David Poyle retiring at some point? Is it set up to a level now where it's not all dependent on one person or one aspect of this organization? Is it an organization that's set up to succeed where when David Poyle does decide to retire, his assistant GM can get the job and the Preds can keep right on moving along, spending money, making money, doing things the way you need to in the NHL?
Yeah, I don't have any doubt that that's, I mean, it's going to happen, right? I mean, I assume David Poyle will want to retire at some point. And
certainly you're always one sell away from that changing if the ownership was to change. But
yeah, no, my sense of where the Preds are at now is that, you know, they would withstand lots of different things now. It's funny, I can't remember who I was having this discussion with, though. We were talking about Carolina, of course, you know, a team, you know, in the middle of ongoing tumult, and, you know, just hired Rod Brind'Amour, who I really like. I think that's a great hire as a head coach. Haven't been in the playoffs since 08. So that's whatever, that 9 years in a row, whatever it is. Haven't been there.
And won a Stanley Cup in 06? Was that the year they won?
09, sorry. They went to the East Final and lost. They got swept by Pittsburgh in 09, the year that the Penguins won the Cup. So haven't been since 09. No one goes to those games. Fans have been beaten down. The ownership was absentee. Peter Karmanos, before he sold to Tom Dundon, the Texas billionaire. So what would happen in Nashville? Like, if the Preds missed the playoffs for 8 straight years, what would happen here? I don't know. Hard to tell. It's hard to imagine that would ever happen, because I don't think this team is built to not make the playoffs. But I just think this is such a strong hockey market now that all those things that you're talking about, at some point David Poile will retire. Maybe Paul Fenton's going to go on and be the GM in Minnesota. Maybe he takes over if he stays here as a GM, or someone else. Tom Fitzgerald comes back and is the GM, or David's son, whatever, however it plays out. This team, again, because of the stability and consistency, I see it that they won't miss a beat. And I think that's what model franchises do.
Scott Burnside from The Athletic in studio with us. You've been around this team for every playoff game now. Aside from the talent on the ice, what are some of the qualities that you've picked up on that separates this team from the rest?
It's been such a fascinating series with Winnipeg, because they're very similar, except they're at different stages of their revolution, right? The Preds are built. They're built for Game 7. They're built to win this series. They're built to win the Stanley Cup. Tampa's really good, I've long ago stopped trying to figure out what Vegas is going to do, right? But because they just keep doing the opposite. But I think there are a lot of hockey people who believe that the winner Thursday night is the team that's going to hoist the Stanley Cup in about 4 weeks or whenever it's going to be.
Do you believe that?
I do believe that, but also wise enough to know that I really don't know anything about predicting. So, I get that part of my own shortcomings, but I do believe that whoever wins tomorrow night will win the Stanley Cup, because that's how good they are. And both teams are built the same kind of way. Built to play, it's why it's been so fun to watch, because when the Jets get going, they're a lot like the Preds when the Preds get going. And it's interesting that the Preds have had to change how they've approached the game in order to vanquish Winnipeg. They can't play run and gun with them. Winnipeg's too good, and it goes back to some of what we were talking about, because if your second line's not producing, their top six are off the charts. And when they go, there's no one, no one can handle them. And Byfuglien is a figure when he's been going that has been a difference maker in the series. So, but you know what I like about this team is there's a real sense of, sort of commitment. Like I never, when you get beat as badly as you do in game 5 and you have to go to Winnipeg, you've already won there. So your chances now of winning again are, logic tells you it's going to be hard to win there for a game that is hugely historic magnitude for Winnipeg, never been to a conference final. So all those things. And you talk to Ryan Johansson or Ryan Ellison. It's like, hey, the guarantee, P.K. Subban's guarantee, that, come on. I don't like, the guarantees. John Tortorella guaranteed a game 7 in the first round. It didn't happen. That's just noise. But I was just, there was no sense of, there was a sense of, it's okay. We got this.
It felt like he believed it.
Yeah.
He said it was so matter of fact,
They've rebounded off of losses throughout the season to where, as bad as Game 5 was, they treated it just like another loss as they moved forward. They didn't put added pressure on themselves.
Well, and I think
at least
that's
it didn't seem that way.
Yeah, no, and I think there's a maturity to it. I mean, Winnipeg could win 6-0 tomorrow night. It's entirely possible Nashville will win 4-0, just as they did the other night. That's the great thing. You don't know, but I think this is a team that believes that they're built for this moment, and they believe that they're built to go back and right the wrong or rewrite the script that eluded them last year in the playoffs. And you talk about Pekka, and it's been a weird series for him. It's been a weird spring. But boy, was he good in game 6. And if he's good like that tomorrow night, they're going to win that game. I believe that. So, and he and I had a long chat at one point during the playoffs, and just about wanting to get back to that moment and, you know, what it was like to listen to Pittsburgh celebrate in their building and being down the hallway and hearing what was going on in their arena. And I just think there's, you know, there's a real sort of quiet confidence here. And that's, again, that's what elite teams, you know, some teams, they don't get that. They don't know who they are yet. And I think it'll be fascinating to see Winnipeg tomorrow night because they're a team that has learned very, very quickly, very mature. Their leadership group is rock solid. Like they will put that game behind them just like the Predators put game five behind them. And that's why I think tomorrow night's going to be, it's going to be so much fun.
We had a Finnish broadcaster on the show earlier in this series. And after game three, the debacle for the Preds, up 3-0, and Pekka Rinne had the slash on the player late in the game out of frustration. And I remember asking this Finnish broadcaster who knows Pekka Rinne well, who's covered him throughout his career, about how that was uncharacteristic of Pekka Rinne. And he cut us off and he said, it's not uncharacteristic at all. That is the fire that burns within him at all times. If you know him at all, he is that angry when he's on the ice at all times. He just does a good job of hiding it. You've dealt with Pekka Rinne before. Do you sense that about him as well?
Yeah, I don't know the fire part, but you know, over the years, I've spent a fair amount of time with him, and I was always struck by I always think of him as a gentle soul, right? Like I think he's a very, and I don't mean it like not passive or anything like. He's sort of a gentle soul, and I know, you know, this is his team. Right, used to be, maybe it was Shea Weber's team. I remember talking to David Poile 2 or 3 years ago. We were talking about Pekka Rinne, and he said, "Listen, you know, Shea Weber is a big personality. He's the captain. There's all those things, but this is as much Pekka's team, and now it is his team, and it's, you know, this is his town. I think it's such a great story because he's grown up with this franchise, and you know, he's a guy who has come so far." And really wants, I think he really understands what it would be like to win a cup in this community for this town and for this franchise. And I'll be shocked if we don't see vintage Pekka Rinne in game seven. And as I say, if you see what you saw in game six, then the Preds should win that game.
You know, it's so difficult to find a common denominator from game to game in this series because, like you said, there are so much change in between the games. But if I'm looking for something, and I'm looking at Game 4 and Game 6 for Nashville and how great they were in those games, it was the defensive style they played, but it was also the ability to score early and score first that allowed them to not press and to play that style. Do you feel like that's a big factor in the ability for the Preds to play a more aggressive defensive style in Game 7 to get that first goal?
I think it's very important for them to score first. And I mean, you saw what happened in game five where, you know, even when you tied it, you know, you get the Yannick Weber goal but then they score basically three right. I mean, they bury you.
Within 5 minutes, yeah, they score three more.
Yeah. But I think one of the keys will be not giving up four goals in the second period. So that's happened twice in this series. So that would be, if I was going to put one, number one.
Put that up on the board. Pierre Laviolette's putting that up on the board right now. Don't give up four goals in the second period.
Not a four spot. But you're right. And scoring first, you know, it changes things a little bit for Winnipeg. And I think it's a miss. You know, what I've liked about what the Preds have done is that Paul Maurice at one point said, well, they stopped attacking in game four. And I'm not sure that's necessarily accurate. What they did was disrupt the neutral zone and became much more a turnover-based, a counterattack team, which is something different than maybe what we saw from them a lot during the regular season. So I like that they were patient enough to do that because this, you know, this will be about patience. And if you don't have the patience and if you open it up, again, I just think that's a match you can't win against this Winnipeg team. If you start to open it up, they get just too many weapons and they can hurt you in too many different ways. And so I think what the Predators have to play the way that we saw them play in games four and six. And that will mean patience. It will mean who doesn't want to score first, right? No coach comes out and says, we'd like to give up a couple, right? Because we don't play until we get
We need to settle in.
We need to settle in.
We got them right where we want them, down 3-0 in this first period. That's exactly where we want them.
That's right. So, and both teams obviously will want to get the other team off their game. But I think that will, if the Preds are able to score first, that's going to change the dynamic. It's going to allow them to approach the game in the way they did in game 4 and 6. If you get down a goal or two, then you change. Then you are chasing. You're chasing it, and you have to open it up, and you have to open yourself up to giving up odd man rushes. And then and we've seen what happens when that happens in the series, and that's when the Jets prevail. And if it, you know, if the Jets are able to exert their will early in the game, then it's going to be trouble.
PK Subban, polarizing figure across the hockey world, Scott, a guy who wanted to be the captain of the Montreal Canadiens. Do you get the sense that he's able to be more of a leader here than ever before?
I think so. And I think maybe what has allowed him to find a comfort zone, I'm not speaking for him, but my sense of this is that, you know, it's a room with a lot of strong personalities. It's a room with a lot of, you know, sort of go-to guys, you know, whether it's Roman Josi, whether it's Pekka Rinne. Ryan Ellis has emerged. It was interesting, you know, talking to David Poile, when they named Roman Josi captain, it was really important for them to also name Ryan Ellis associate captain. That was came down to two guys that were going to be captains. It was either going to be Roman Josi or Ryan Ellis. You've got, you know, veteran guys, you know, Scott Hartnell's, you know, come back here. And I think what it's allowed, you know, PK Subban's a big force. He's a big personality. There's no question he rankled people in Montreal, whether it was the media or within the room. I just think the personality of this team has allowed him to be PK Subban, to be the big personality, but also to thrive here. And I think, you know, I don't think he could do that everywhere. And obviously, it didn't work in Montreal. But I mean, this deal, with all due respect, I think everyone looks at this deal now and they're like, you know, this is a good deal for the Nashville Predators.
Yes.
Just the way the game's played, you know, and, you know, the age difference and, you know, all those things. I think it's a nice fit. And you know, I think there are enough people that if PK Subban gets, if there's too much PK, I think there are people in that room who say, okay, let's just dial it back here a little bit. And again, I think that's part of, you know, Mike Fisher, you know, him coming back into the room. You know, there's just, I think there are a lot of real strong personalities in there and a lot of leaders. And I think that's a good place for PK Subban to be.
And you mentioned another great deal, getting Ryan Johansson. He's played in 26 postseason games for the Preds. He has 26 points and his rating is plus 17. Huge impact in the postseason since he's been acquired. Is he inserting himself as that, in that class of elite centers in the NHL?
Well, I think so. You know what I mean? He didn't, you know, his point totals during the regular season were fairly pedestrian and, you know, a big contract and all those kinds of things. He and I chatted at the start of this series, I guess. And he said, you know, last spring was really important to him, right? He took on Jonathan Toews and he took on Paul Stastny or whoever was playing number one in St. Louis. And he was going toe-to-toe with Getzlaff and Kessler against Anaheim before he got hurt. Those were important moments for him. And I think they were important moments around the NHL for people to go, okay, you know, he's the real deal. Right? He's a B. And this spring, like if you had to vote, you know, where's your Conn Smythe list for the Predators right now? You know, Philip Forsberg, sure. I would have Ryan Johansson at the top of that list. He would be the guy. I think he is the guy game in and game out who has delivered the goods consistently. And we can't say that about everybody in that lineup. And I think he is opening eyes again following up last year. And you know what? At this stage, it doesn't matter what his regular season looked like because he is bringing the goods when it matters the most. And I, again, you know, we talked about Pekka Rinne. I think Pekka will be strong tomorrow night. And I think what you're going to see is Ryan Johansson. And whether he's playing against Mark Scheifele or whether he's playing against Paul Stastny, however Peter Laviolette decides to go, I think you'll see another excellent performance from Ryan Johansson because that's what he's delivered all spring.
If you pull back to 30,000 feet looking at the league, where is Forsberg among young creative forwards in the league?
Yeah, I think he's right up there. And I think, you know, when you don't see him as often or you don't see him up close, he's a big boy. He's not afraid of anything. And that's, so he's not a skill guy like Patrick Kane. And I'm not saying Patrick Kane's afraid of anything, but, you know, Patrick Kane plays a different game. High-end skill game, smaller body, just does things differently. Forsberg's, you know, surprisingly physical, and the way he's driving the net and the plays that he's making, you know, I don't know, you know, is he top 10 for sure? you know, where do you put him after that? But he's, you know, again, you get a lot of argument. You know, if you had to give the Conn Smythe today to somebody from Nashville, a lot of people would say Philip Forsberg, and he has scored big goals, and so he deserves all the credit he's getting.
And tomorrow is the stage for him. You know, he's a star, but game sevens with the entire country of Canada watching and the entire NHL world, because we've had two straight nights of no hockey. Game seven in the playoffs, he has a chance to put a stamp on superstar.
Yep.
And continue to climb that ladder.
For sure. Yeah, no question about it. And this, you know, that's what game sevens are made for, right? I mean, I'm sure, you know, Mark Scheifele, who is, you know, people don't know how good Mark Scheifele is. He's top five center in the NHL. That he just is. He's unbelievable. Blake Wheeler, you know, they're in that room. They're saying, this is our time. This is our time. And so, you know, that's going to be the great part of it. You know, which of the big boys is going to do enough? Who pushes the other one off the mountain? It's going to be terrific theater.
Hey, tell us what you're working on for tomorrow on The Athletic. It may be out later tonight, maybe.
Later tonight, if I'm productive this afternoon, it'll be a piece just looking at the Game 7 from the Predators' perspective. Talked to Terry Crisp. It was great.
Awesome.
Million stories there. Talked to Paul Gostad, and later this afternoon, hope talked to Barrett Jackman, both of whom were with the Preds 2 years ago when they won a Game 7 and lost a Game 7. So, here you go.
That's the perspective of Game 7 that you can find right now or later today at The Athletic from Scott Burnside, who's been nice enough to join us in studio. Thank you so much for doing this.
Anytime.
When you're in town, to come in studio is that extra notch for us, and we appreciate you joining us this hour.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, anytime, guys.
Scott Burnside has been our guest here on the Midday 180. That was awesome.